extra wind tunnel models, and that we'd usually wind up that we had done about, when they got through with the final design, there was only about a 10% change, and we could recognize what we did. The Bell X1, as an example, had to be carried aloft by a B-29 bomber at 35,000 feet, dropped, because it only had 6,000 pounds of thrust, and it could, at the 6,000 pounds of thrust, it only had about 60, and later on they had 90 seconds of propulsion before they came back to Earth as a glider. The wing had to be a very thin wing, would have no structure in it. The wings had to be made of forged aluminum and then machined to the point where the leading edge was so sharp that we used to state, "We are looking for a razor blade manufacturer to make our leading edges." And they did one thing, the whole rear tail surface was, instead of having the split flap for the flaps in the back, the whole thing changed, because that was the one thing that kept the tail surfaces from propagating a shock wave. Because once behind a shock wave, whatever you've got there is meaningless. Start out with a sharp nose and that's it, and firepower at the back, and that's the ultimate streamlining. And when the firepower goes, if you're at lower altitude, the aerodynamic braking, you develop an enormous amount of pressure drag from the rear. And this applies to automobiles, it applies to aircraft also. Unfortunately, just to show you at times what a penalty you're paying for for freezing a design and not continuing the one after it, the state of the art in those days was that airplanes should have a straight leading edge. And if you wanted to go fast, you would sweep the wings back. But George Cornelius and I developed what we thought would be the ultimate wing, and that was a swept forward wing. And I have drawings, I think I have some drawings here I will show you, of the swept forward wing fighter planes, which were impossible to build in those days because of the tremendous stresses on swept forward wings versus trailing edge. The drag and the forces would terminate to the rear of the wing. And that someday we might learn how to come up with structural improvements. The latest state of the art, as an example, on the F-15 and the F-16 is that they're going to swept forward wings. Not only do they lower the critical Mach numbers of flight, they're better streamlined, and they eliminate one of the greatest dreads in an airplane, and that is the wingtip stall. Coming in on the landing, the last thing that will stall will be your swept forward wings. With the straight leading edge wing, you got to remember that the Messerschmitt ME-163s about that time had this sweepback wings. And they were the fastest airplanes in the world. Royal Air Force used to clock them at 0.85 numbers, Mach numbers. And of course, they only had enough fuel for 6 or 7 minutes, maybe 8 minutes. But they were very dramatic designs, and they pointed the way to at least sweepback wings is one way to lower the potential drag. And for 12 years of refinement on the Bell X-1. We use that poor airplane, but we refined it to the point as it got a little bit larger, could carry more fuel, that it eventually was nurtured on up to 2,000 miles an hour. And we never did publicize the fact that that in 1945, for some strange reason, we took the airplane up to 45,000 feet, maximum altitude of the B-29 bomber, the carrying bomber. And the airplane then, the X-1, then shot up to 70,000 feet and recorded a Mach 1 number. But the problem was, the speed of sound at sea level is 764 miles an hour. In the stratosphere, 35 to 50,000 feet, it drops down to 664 miles an hour. So they probably went 665, which was Mach 1, but that was done at 70,000 feet altitude. How do you tell the public that they went 650 miles an hour when they've been programmed that the speed of sound is 1,100 feet per second, 764 miles an hour at sea level? So the number, the 764, it didn't appear till about 2 or 3 years after the war ended. And then from then on, it went up through General Yeager, who's the chief test pilot on that thing. In a way, it was a contribution, but it took 12 years of static, just stood there, and slowly refined. And I'm always suspicious of anything that's been around for too many years. And here I am here, we're showing the Tucker automobile, and that's 38 years old, and it hangs on. A lot of it I owe to my aircraft experience, and the car never would have looked like that if I hadn't treated it as an airplane with four wheels, a passenger carrying thing. These are some of the things that make me a bit on the controversial side. Some people say that, well, you're talking of a philosophy that when the time comes, in advanced styling, when we hit the absolute end, not only will they all look the same, but that's the public will never buy an automobile where they all look the same. And of course, I bombard them with answering by quoting five or six different automobiles and stating that these cars have the same CX in all ranges. They're all a little bit different. And then I say, I just ran the Goodyear blimp through my computer, and I turned over and faced Giorgio Giugiaro, Italy's greatest designer, who designed a car called the Medusa. They had a coefficient of drag of 0.235, and I just tell them that the computer says the Goodyear blimp has the same coefficient of drag, and that here's five different philosophies. They all have the same CD, and there's a lot of flexibility. You can quote certain airplanes, a Constellation versus the DC-8 or 9 or whatever it was. Both weigh the same. Both have the same horsepower. And both fly just as fast. One has three tails. The other has one tail. And one's got a shape that that certainly isn't symmetrical, that we'll never stop. We'll always find a better way. And what shocks me is that I believe that the next major step is going to be when we hit the low numbers, such as the probe at 0.15, you know, somebody's going to get down to 0.112. I'm already there, but I have three-wheel vehicles that are doing it that way. And then if I want to get lower than that, then I'll go to the Ford Gyron concept that I was in charge of. Now I come to the ultimate state of the art as we look at it today. to me, it's got to be a gyro-stabilized two-wheel vehicle. Now, the one big mystery is what really happens underneath an automobile. Even our wind tunnels don't tell us exactly what happens. You can go to an AIA meeting and talk to 10 of the leading aerodynamicists and say, where do we put the ground board here? You get 10 different opinions. And some go back to, why don't we go back to Kempler and Paul Jarret and use the image models. Build two models. You connect the wheels together upside down and then just blow air through it. Take the total drag, divide it by two, which is real simple, and that tells you what's happening underneath. The next step after that, I sort of proved the point with the Ford Mexico. That was probably the best model that I had designed. And it was done strictly because Henry Ford was embarrassed at an accident that occurred at Daytona Beach when our T-Birds were crossing swords. Should I turn some air conditioning on? Does that affect this at all? One of our T-Birds, with all the cameras of the world looking at it and photographing it, at 135 miles an hour, suddenly stood on its nose like this, went upside down, and went for 1,500 feet. And as it was, all the damn cameras in the world were focused on it. Fortunately, the driver wasn't hurt. But Daytona Beach is a very rough thing. And Henry Ford says, what happened? I told him that, number one, we know that with the T-Bird, we're developing 600 pounds of lift over the rear wheels at a speed of 100 miles an hour. And since lift is a function of the square, you go twice as fast, you lift four times as much, and that applies for drag, that this car could have been generating, at that speed, 1,300, 1,400 pounds over the rear, and that's more weight than the rear had, and had no way to go. It must have hit a bump, 2 or 3 degrees would have triggered it, and away. Could I order some coffee? We can send coffee up or something, whatever you like. Okay. Yeah. He said, what do we do? I said, well, I got to design a zero-lift automobile. And I don't know who's going to pay for the project and all that, but he okayed a wind tunnel program. And I had to go to the top of that. And I said, let's call it the Mexico, for the Mexican road race. Okay. Charlie Waterhouse at that time was my boss. And he said, how long is it going to take you to do this? I said, I'm going to do it in a week. He said, what are you talking about in a week? You just spent 4 months on La Tosca. And that's a 3/8 size model. And I said, look, La Tosca was the toughest automobile to design. I came up with a radical canted fender. As it flowed along, there's a lot of funny twists there. There's a lot of optical illusions we have to compensate for. And I tore the model up and down, changed it so many times. And I did this because I wanted to show my students that I'm a professional designer, but I have a terrible time designing an automobile. And I said, but the Mexico is different. I'm going to do it in a week. He says, when are you going to make the templates? I said, I'll do that Saturday. I'll come to work Saturday. And after Saturday, all I want is 5 days. And he said, I'll buy the best steaks in the restaurants for your whole group here. And I had about 25 guys. He wound up with a bill of about close to $300. But I got the thing done. And he says, how come it's going to take 5 days when you struggle on some of these for months? I said, because in the 5 days, when I get a blank check, I know what I'm doing. I'm going to do exactly what I want. So I designed this car And we went to the wind tunnel. Before we went to the wind tunnel, I made a statement that that the CD would be either 2-2 or 2-3. And University of Maryland said, this guy's an idiot. What makes him think he can look at an automobile and tell us what the CD is without a wind tunnel? Of course, wind tunnel time is $900 an hour. And but I said, I got to put an underpan on it. No. Forward, they said, you don't put an underpan on. We don't need it. But I said, we'll never really be able to solve. What I've got to do is develop a zero-lift automobile. No more of our T-birds standing on their noses and all that. So I was ordered not to to spend the time with an underpan. But I figured what I'll do, I'm going to put one on anyway. And I don't exactly win popularity contests. I'll put one on anyway. And Romine Hammond and I stayed up at night. We took some aluminum. And we took some flush screws. And we put a beautiful underpan under the Mexico. Now it gets down to Maryland. And Bill Bowman, who was going to do the aerodynamics and reduce all the data to us, got the shock of his life. And he said, they looked at the thing, and he says, oh my God, it's going to take us 2 hours to get rid of all these screws, to take the underpan off. So they decided, we'll make a real quick run with the underpan on. And the underpan, with the underpan on, aerodynamic lift was absolutely insignificant. What used to be 600 pounds lift on the T-Bird was now reduced to something like 40 pounds, which is negligible. And that they extrapolated, when can we get the rear end airborne? They figured, they scaled it up to 400 miles an hour. And then you would lose traction over the rear. And if you lost traction over the rear, but it would be an impossibility to design anything like that, require 2,400 horsepower, and the car's too small for that. But at least they came out with the numbers. This is a very safe automobile. In fact, it was safer at 200 miles an hour than the typical T-Bird was at 100 miles an hour. We had yaw tests under cross conditions and all that. And it came out of the wind tunnel at 2.225, they got different readings, and they couldn't believe the numbers. So they ran two or three tests, and then they took it off. Then they took the thing off, and the CD went all the way up to 4. My God, we had cut the drag in half. It meant that this would have been the ultimate car for us to use at the Mexican road race. And then we start planning. Then I made some detailed studies on the map. And the cars to beat was a Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing. Had to knock that off. And then the Lancia, they were out and out race cars. And I figured, well, number one, of course, we were to build a tubular frame. I was going to lower the weight down to 2,500 pounds. And the numbers stated that we could reach 200 miles an hour with just 240 horsepower. And with the Mercury Marauder engine, if we use that engine at 400 horsepower, we could reach speeds of 240 miles an hour. Now bear in mind, to take a stock T-Bird through the air and force it through the air at 200 miles an hour required 710 horsepower. So, and here we're doing the same thing with 240 horsepower. It opened up a lot of doors. Instead of building a bigger engine for the Mercury versus the Ford, you could use the Ford engine and still outperform the bigger engine if you lowered the coefficient of drag. So I was thinking way ahead. We're going to run into an economy race someday, and it's going to be murder. We're going to have to talk of cars that are capable of, we just simply have to double our fuel economy numbers, and actually they're starting to do that now. It's amazing the progress that's going on in some of our the new Ford products. But that's just the beginning.
What happened to the Mexico?
The Mexico project was scrapped. It got as high as a 3/8 size model. I've heard rumors that all my models were destroyed after I left the Ford Motor Car Company. Then someone says, no, there some of them they unearthed. Rather than destroy them, somebody put them in the, at the old Rouge plant in a corner and put a lot of heavy tarp over it. And they lifted up and saw these things. They were deteriorating. The paint jobs were and they'll have to be refurbished. Now, supposedly, they got 5 or 6 of these models out of perhaps 20 models that we had. Then there were rumors one time circulating over the past 20 years that all the models were gone except the Mexico, which was still considered forward, should be preserved because of its aerodynamics. And I could have lowered the aerodynamics on it, but my problem was instead of a real fastback, which would generate lift, I would solve all that through reducing the lift over the canopy. And
you come out of the Air Force imbued with your enthusiasm for aerodynamic design, reinforced by the experiences in the Air Force.
Yeah.
You are now about to embark on one of your most significant post-war enterprises.
Yeah.
For which we are here today in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
The celebration of the Tucker automobile.
Oh, yes. Yes.
When did you first meet Preston Tucker?
I met Preston Tucker Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve, 1946. He asked me to design an automobile. Gave me 5 days to come up with a theme. And he stopped in at Tammann and Dennison, where I was an industrial designer, New Year's Eve on his way to a party. Looked at my sketches and said, that's it. I says, wait a minute, I'm just trying to get warmed up. He says, no. He says, the trouble with you designers, it takes two to design an automobile. One to start laying out the thing, and when the guy who's watching the design evolve take place, to hit you on the head with a hammer and stop you and freeze the design. I said, it's going to take a lot of refinement. He said, don't worry about it. Then he said, I've got to have a car built in 60 days. I said, that's impossible, absolutely impossible. And he said, I said, it's going to take 90 days to build a clay model. And he said, who said clay? And he said, I got the best metal men in the world working here. And this is an utter, no, we're going to bypass clay. At that time, we had no body engineering group and all that. We started out with this automobile. It was the most hectic project I've ever had in my entire career. We'd go forward, we'd have a setback, things wouldn't work, the surfaces wouldn't look right. We didn't have a model to... Oh, good. Do you like sugar, cream? We didn't have a pattern shop, but I'll say one thing, the heaviest talent I've ever seen at the Indianapolis race course beautiful bodies built by some of the world's greatest hammer men in the world. Is there anything? I see. Yeah. And the car that we have over here is the Tin Goose. We call it the Tin Goose with a lot of affection because the name was inspired, as far as I was concerned, by Bill Stout's fabulous Ford Tri-Motor. That was called the Tin Goose. Very amazing aeroplane. I had the pleasure of talking to him on that aeroplane. At one time he was carrying 60 refugees. How they could get 60 people in a Ford Tri-Motor, but they were flying it, he told me. He said the pilot was flying it just 5 foot off the water, and he was attacked by three or four Zeros that were diving down on it, and all the Zeros couldn't put their gun sights on it and pull out fast enough, and four or five Zeros just went right into the water. And this aeroplane, it may have been an old fuddy-duddy, but by God, it still worked and could do things that... And coming right straight from Bill Stout was fabulous. Because I remember he used to visit us. I'm scattering around an awful lot. There's no organization of what I'm talking about, so you'll have to... As an example, when he would visit us once a month. He was a magnificent guy, a very inspiring man. And as he would leave Aircraft Laboratory, he would say, 1 pound per horsepower, 100 cubic inches, $1 a pound, which meant 100 horsepower engine. Now, this had applications with aircraft technology that would filter on down to an automobile. And this is the thinking that we should do. We should strive for a lower weight and all that. And why do we have to build aircraft engines that don't even come close to 1 pound per horsepower? Could be productionized. Let's see, I got off the track with Bill Stout.
One question about Bill Stout. His Scarab automobile was quite an advanced design.
Yes, it was. It was a very simple shape. No one's ever put it in the wind tunnel. But just looking at it and guessing, I would say that the Scarab has to be, ignoring the fact, I don't know what the underpan was. Maybe it didn't have an underpan, but with an underpan, it would have been 0.30, and maybe without it, 0.35. Sure, it was a clean, basic shape, and a simple shape. It wasn't a three-box design thing. He was quite a genius. He had a very good suspension in the thing, and he cooled it by sucking air into the rear, which works on a big body like that, but it doesn't work in a car like the Tucker. The secret of the Tucker automobile is that I take air in through the two fender scoops, and we also have a scoop on the bottom of the car that with only 80 square inches of entry air, I can cool the car, providing I push the air out of the car, but not take it in the low pressure area, as they do on buses or single bodies of revolution like a Greyhound bus or a square or elliptical shape. The big thing is that we have for years ignored the internal drag that happens on all automobiles, such as we have designed what I call the open fireplace school of thought. All that's missing is a log. And we've been told that we need 250 square inches of opening. And if you put a grill there, you got to measure the grill and deduct that. All right, 250 square inches, or the thing won't cool. Aircraft people, the most classic example I can think of is the P-40 aeroplane versus the P-51 aeroplane, the Mustang. Both aeroplanes had the same engine. They had the same wing loading. They had the same weight. One airplane could go 50 miles an hour faster than the other. And the secret of the P-51 was they took air in the bottom. Remember that blister on the bottom, air intake? They preserved 50 to 60% of the air going over the fuselage, totally uninterrupted, except at the bottom it would enter the air duct through the radiator core and went out through a wastegate. And as the air got heated, it expanded and gave you a poor man's form of jet propulsion. This is something for nothing. Now, we have completely ignored what happens underneath the hood on an automobile. Years ago, we used to put louvers. Packard used to have doors that opened up. I don't care how big the mouth is, you can only take air in as fast as you can expel it. So once the engineering tells us what the requirements are, volume of air in cubic feet per minute, it's very simple to design the air entry thing, and it should be ducted, because 6% of the drag is associated, in some cars it's as high as 10%. And that's an awful penalty to pay when you're shooting for miles per gallon and a lot of efficiency. And the ducted air entry ducts and cooling systems were developed years ago, and we completely ignored them. Good Lord, sometimes I think radiators should be in the rear and you block up the whole nose and pipe the water there. Or another thing that worries me now, we've taken the engine that used to go north-south, now it's an east-west engine. It's a blockbuster, and we got a radiator core there. The air gets in there. It doesn't know where to go. It has to somehow, some of it gets sucked out the bottom. That's why we put spoilers on the front end to create a pressure evacuation area. And we could be so far ahead if we would just go and look at some of these aircraft techniques. Now, the Probe 5, as an example, is possibly the best aerodynamic car that's ever been developed to date. Their secret is they're taking air in through the rear fenders and shoving it out the back. And that's where the drastic reduction in CD numbers have come. Now, they're down to 0.15. We may have to go 10 years before we see normal stock cars at a CD of that. But this is the exploration of the future. This is what I call advanced styling. You're probing into the future. The name is a hell of a good name, Probe 12345. It shows a development. The other thing that's going to be, I think the next big tremendous breakthrough is going to come through boundary air layer control that we use on aircraft. As an example, take an F-104 fighter plane. It's winged. It's a clip wing version. It's an old airplane, but it's still one of the fastest airplanes in the world. The thing will still climb 1,400 miles an hour vertically and get up there, way upstairs. It's a smaller airplane. It doesn't carry a lot of bombs or rockets and all. And its secret is the air drag over the wings is so low because of the boundary air layer control. In other words, when they come in for a landing, if their pump should fail, that airplane has to come in at 250 miles an hour, and the tires would never survive 200 miles an hour. It'd be a crash. The orders to all of them, all the pilots who fly those, are if you lose your pumping power, just bail out, get out, and sacrifice the plane. Most of the airplanes we've sent to the Luftwaffe, they're in Germany, they are using those airplanes. I guess they've lost 50 or 60 people. But once you turn the suction pumps on, you can lower your speeds very drastically to where you come in at about 120 miles an hour. I see these airliners. If we ever use boundary air layer control, this 140 mile an hour landing speeds or touchdown speeds could be well reduced to 65, 70 miles an hour. And can you visualize a 747 coming in at 60 miles an hour? It'd be a slow boat to China. You wouldn't believe it. But that could happen. And if so, we could shorten our landing field and give you a greater cushion. The technology is there. All we have to do is use it.
Can this new theory be applied to automobiles as well?
Oh, very definitely. In fact, the way I look at it, you have to develop a suction pump. And what I feel, and the calculations I've come with, a lot of people disagree with me, but that's all right. I don't care about that. I don't hit it all the time. But I say, I take the turbocharger. I don't feed it into the engine. I feed it into a pump. And I'll reduce the drag to the point where turbocharging just the aerodynamic coach works a hell of a lot better than turbocharging the engine. So that could be a breakthrough there. This way you could build some very odd shaped cars that are aerodynamically unsound, like the Chrysler K series. There, to me, there certainly aren't aerodynamic at all. But if you put a bunch of holes in there and force the air to stop and turn a right-handed corner, go all the way down, and then start preserving the boundary layer, once the air separates and the body surface drag goes up, and you leave an enormous wake of disturbance, which is suction. It even fouls up the gravel. It sucks the gravel. We're ruining our off parking areas because of aerodynamic monstrosities. But that could be way in the future. It's when we start shooting for the lowest numbers possible, and this is a challenge. Ford came up with 0.15. Now General Motors has a car. They claim they got 0.14. And we'll see. There's a lot of differences in wind tunnels. There's a lot of cheating going on in wind tunnels. If you can make the car put softer shocks on it and make the rear end rise just 1.5 degrees, that's 0.02 counts improvement. And the big battle waging between the Camaro and the Trans Ams. The Trans Am is better than the Camaro. Because Trans Am is cheating. The other thing is they've got open headlights, retractable headlights. One has retractable and the other doesn't. And in order to really say which is the best car, both cars should be raced at night when they both have their headlights up. And one has them up, and that's going to lose its shirt with 0.02, 0.03 counts. And in the daytime, you should buy two cars. You should buy a Camaro for the daytime, and you should buy a Trans Am the daytime and a Camaro for night fighting. So it's getting to be an exciting field.
Yes. I'd like to get back to that in a few minutes. But one more question about the 30s, if I may.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about Buckminster Fuller and his Dymaxion and later versions of that?
You know, I was inspired by that automobile many, many years ago, just looking at the numbers and the statistics. Now, if I recall, that car had an 85 horsepower engine, which is a Ford engine, and it reached a speed of 120 miles an hour, which is very, very impressive with that horsepower. I forget how many people it carried, but the engine was in the rear, and the front wheels went straight ahead, and it steered with the rear wheel. It had a very unfortunate accident that killed three members of the Graf Zeppelin crew. And the accident happened at about 35 miles an hour when someone on the expressway decided to take a closer look and got in real close. And in order to avoid what had happened, They steered with the wheel trying to get away, ran into a curbstone, and then rolled over. And that accident certainly went a long ways to destroying the concept of three-wheel automobiles.
Which you later revived at Ford and with the
Gyron. Oh, yes. Oh, with the Gyron with two wheels. We used to say the argument is four wheels are too many. Earl McPherson, our chief engineer, and you got to respect him. Earl McPherson, in my opinion, 100 years from now, will still be highly respected as the father of the McPherson strut. And I'm not talking of a dance step. I mean, that's it. And a man of tremendous creativity and engineering. When he did the small GM light car, Ford hired him right on the spot. There's no doubt about it. But he certainly didn't like me, and he just didn't like stylists. The only stylist he ever liked, though, I got to give him credit for this, he liked Gil Spear. Now, Gil Spear, in my opinion, when we were talking to the Ford Motor Car Company Advanced Styling, he was Mr. Advanced Styling, as far as I'm concerned. He came up with some very fantastic, wait a minute, I'm sort of disturbed with the telephone, fantastic car called the Certus. And he had engineered, or better yet, imagineered what no engineer could have done. They would have gone so much paper. He would just sit there, and linkage this way, we'll do this. And he made it work, a 3/8 size model. Not only would the roof open up when the deck lid went up, that included the rear window that went up. He could do things with this car that no one in the world could ever do. Not only did the top fold down and disappear, and then the rear window went forward over where the rear passengers, and it was a double cowled Phaeton, a double windshield Phaeton. And when two windshields in an open car protecting the rear passengers who can't survive 40 miles an hour in the rear seat, this was a real achievement. And it was the catalyst that gave us the Ford retractables. Skyliner. Yeah, the Skyliner, and they wanted desperately to use it on the new Lincoln Continentals. It was easier to do it in those days when the cars were a little bit higher, but as they got lower and the belt line shrank, all this mechanism didn't have enough room. But Earl McPherson was absolutely convinced that Gil Spear is not only, he'd ignore the styling, he is not only the tremendous stylist, but this guy is a brilliant engineer. And I had tremendous respect for all the models. He did a car called the Muroc, which was a very interesting car. God, I forget the names of the cars. But when they put on that show at the Ford Motor Car Company, and they invited all the stylists, I was at Kaiser Fraser at that time, and when I saw those beautiful models, I just went out of my mind. I says, my God, this is the company to really join someday. And I figured, I was starting to hear the death rattle of Kaiser Fraser anyway, and I figured it's going to be Ford. That's the only company I'd be interested in. But the problem was that Gil was stuck with just building 3/8 size models because at one time when we finally wound up on the second floor, where all advanced styling was to take place, we were confronted with the problem of building full-size clay models that weighed 7,000-8,000 pounds. And they could go through the floor, and that's where our product planning people were. And we used to kid a little bit and say, maybe that's the best thing that would ever happen if we can vaporize those guys downstairs. They're nice guys, but at any rate, product planning is a very important function also. Because it serves the same purpose as it did in aircraft design, and it gives you some idea. You got to always anticipate the enemy. We used to look at, I used to spend an awful lot of time just getting information from the Royal Air Force, what kind of airplanes they chased, and very mysterious airplanes that gun cameras couldn't even catch, such as ramjets. Just getting information from the Royal Air Force, what kind of airplanes they chased, and very mysterious airplanes that gun cameras couldn't even catch, such as ramjets. I was the one that, just from getting a code name, you gotta have a fiendish mind to be to be an automobile designer. There was a project, a top secret German project was called ATHODID. We tried to figure out what it was. And it was spelled ATHODYD. So we all came to the conclusion by just adding some words to it. Air thermal dynamic duct would get you close. And if it's an air thermal dynamic duct, maybe it's a ramjet. Then a Royal Air Force picture was sent to us, and it stated, a Gloucester Meteor shot this through the gun cameras, and that airplane was reputedly flying at 80,000 feet. And the gun cameras don't really show too much resolution, but it looked like a series of dots, but they were elliptical in shape, and there were a few more dots that said, maybe this is a wingtip, maybe it isn't, we don't know what it is. We don't see any semblance of a rear rudder on it. And what do you think it is? So I came up with, I had big blow-ups where all you could see was dots. It looked like he was looking at the constellation of Orion, Orion's belt, nothing but. But then I think it's got to be a ramjet, and it's got to be a big flying barrel. And if it's a flying barrel, where do you put the pilot? Well, you put him in the middle of the barrel, and the only way you can tow him, you've got to have a long nose, and the thing won't fire up if it's a ramjet till you hit 400 miles an hour, and then you turn the fuel on, and then you develop your thrust. It's the cleanest, most efficient thing in a duct like that. Years later, you're saying when I got out of the Air Force, I became a consultant to the Air Force, and I was interviewing Alexander Lippisch, designer of the ME-163. And I showed him a drawing of this, and he said, where did you get this? I said, we just drew it up. And he said, this is possibly one of the greatest German top secret projects. It was called ATHODID. And he says, that's what we called it. We figured it was a air thermal dynamic duct. He says, I can't believe it. I said, well, what did we do wrong on this? He said, that's a funny part of it. You did nothing wrong. And very few of us knew of Operation ATHODID. Now, this is enemy aircraft evaluation. This parallels to automobiles. To me, the enemy is General Motors. You got to set up a department of real advanced thinking stylists, and the credo is to vaporize General Motors or break their necks gently over a period of 5 years. You spend more money on advanced styling, and it'll pay off in production cars. It gets people to start thinking a little bit more in advance.
After the demise of the Tucker, which I suspect was quite a shock for you, and which you described
yes.
in some length in Automobile Quarterly and
elsewhere, yes.
mm-hmm. You went on to Kaiser Frazier from there, did you say?
Yes, I went to Kaiser Frazier. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to go to Chrysler at that time because I always wanted to work for Virgil Exner. I felt that I had been working for some of the world's finest designers, and I'd like to have my career exposed to other great designers because we're two-edged swords and we rub off on each other sometimes, and as far as I was concerned, I figured there's an equal distribution of talent throughout all the three major companies and all that. And it's not the degree of talent that's there. I think the real degree that separates one philosophy from another is the information that you're seeking and what you really want to do better than anyone else. And the freedom of expression. It requires complete freedom of expression. And that to me, and you have to be inquisitive by nature. I could never fathom, as an example, when the production studio, well, let's take a, ignore the styling, we'll just talk of dates. Let's say that we have a clay model called a Lincoln, and this is the year 1960. We're going to build, by the time you see this Lincoln, it's going to be 1962. But this 1962 projected model goes into the showroom, and since it's 1960, we drive in a 1960 Cadillac. So we compare our 1960 Cadillac with the 1962 clay model Lincoln. And we get back and we say, well, the Lincoln is better looking. What we forget is that we don't know what the 1962 Cadillac clay model looks like. Now, that would be a more favorable a way of evaluating and the direction to go. I always felt that we should pull a raid on General Motors, for instance, and try and get one of their top Cadillac designers, put him in the basement, and make sure he has no access to all the other production studios, and just say, your job is to do what you think the 61 Cadillac's going to look like. What's a 62, 65? And by the time 1967, you had 5 years of Cadillacs, you will be stale. Then you can come down and work, come up and work in our studio. But you're going to have to live in the basement, whether you like it or not. But we're going to pay you a lot of money. And we don't have to. You look at automotive news today, and everything is spy pictures. They're showing you. They're showing you the new Cadillac 86 and the new Cadillac 87. I think some of them are horrible. I have an idea. They might be releasing this information just to get the public reaction. If they get the public reaction, they'll say, how come you guys got the best wind tunnel in the world? And your roof lines and notch backs are 10 years old in thinking. They're... You know that they're aerodynamically wrong, and you won't even disclose your CDs because you're too embarrassed. If you have something that you'd like to say, we got a CD of 0.40, well, what you're doing, looking at what you've got, it's more like 4 or 5, and I don't blame you for keeping your mouth shut. I don't. There's letters to the editor in Automotive News where some people say that some of the new GM cars are the ugliest in the world. And I agree. I've heard rumors, stylists saying, boy, we're awfully conservative. I don't know what's happening to us. And they don't want to mention names, and I don't blame them. This is the most competitive business in the world. But you got to have the inspiration from the top. You got to pretend that you're the island of Pina Mundi, where the German rocket, the base was. It only took 40 men, with Dr. von Braun and Hermann Oberth, to design the V-2s. And I was a year ahead of the Germans, but everybody said, this is ridiculous. What are you talking about? I've got a... See if you can find a Operation Dinosaur there, honey. That rocket, vertical rocket. If it wasn't for people... But of course, they tolerate me because they figure he's a dreamer and maybe he might accidentally hit something. And but he really doesn't have a background for aerodynamics. But Dr. von Karman used to look at me, and he was a presidential advisor to President Roosevelt. And he was the father of the supersonic breakthrough. And he said, maybe we've got to... Oh, here, hold that page there, too. This would have been... Yeah. Oh, okay. This airplane I did in 42, four TG-180s wrapped around, no engines in the wings, with 16,000 pounds of thrust. This would have been the first Mach 1 airplane. The pitot-tube, the shish kebab was in the nose. Air entry here. I had openings here for taking air in, which I called thrust augmenters. And that's a state of the art that I said, well, make them bigger and we really get more efficiency. But it started there. Wingtips slashed back like this. Another thing, look at this swept forward thing. And I think the real interesting one, I have to tell you what this is, or you won't believe this.
What is it?
I'm possibly the only designer in the world that was asked to design something for the Russians. When the war ended, the Air Force told me that the Russians want a cargo glider. There's my lunar landing vehicle. I thought I had a dinosaur here. No, it's my 100 mile per gallon thing. Don't tell me I forgot to take... I joined Kaiser Fraser in 1952. Wait a minute, was it 52? Yeah, it must have been... after the Tucker, I joined in 1950. I joined Kaiser Fraser in 1950. When I walked in, it was ironic that they had just had a layoff and six designers were walking out. And of the six designers that were walking out, I was hired. And I was quite impressed with what I saw, because I saw some of the great designers there. They had a triumvirate, let's say, of... Herb Weisinger and Buzz Grissinger and Bob Robillard, who went on to become the chief designer for the Lockheed 1011 the Lockheed 1011 interior styling job, which meant a styling staff of about 150 people. And it looked like all the production designs were really being controlled by Buzz Grissinger and the three designers. And someone had to do some advanced styling work, so I sort of became a self-appointed advanced stylist for Kaiser Fraser. And it led to some advanced projections that PR-wise had a lot of value. It showed what Kaiser Fraser designers were thinking of in terms of the future. But having worked for so many automobile companies, I had seen some of the failures, and I could detect the death rattle sometimes of a company. And when I walked into Kaiser Fraser, I looked at the models, and they were minor changes from the original Dutch Daring. The Dutch Daring car was, of course, the Dutch Daring was the consultant to, hello.
Hi.
How are you? Let's see, we were at...
Darren's designs for Kaiser.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Darren, Howard Dutch Darren was the designer of the last, and not only the first Kaiser Fraser model that eliminated all semblance of fenders, but also the new very good-looking automobile called the one that pioneered the first low belt line and the crash pad, which they inherited from the Tucker Corporation. It was a very nice-looking automobile.
Named after Darren, I think.
Yes, Dutch Darren. He was on a royalty basis at that time, and he used to get approximately $1 a car for every automobile that was built. And also, when he worked on the Henry J, I think he got 75 cents for it, per car. And one of my first projects was, it looks like Sears Roebuck knows how to sell small cars. So I was told to come up with some minor changes so that we can sell this automobile through Sears Roebuck. And all I could see was, well, okay, there's a map of the United States. It's going to say Allstate, and that's what we called it. I designed a hood ornament for it. And that sort of identified it as another automobile. It turned out to be catastrophic. We only sold 400 cars through Sears Roebuck. And that was one of the pitfalls. But one of the big pitfall was this. When Kaiser Fraser, remember, he was a wartime hero. God, that man used to build a tanker with in 5 days. How they did it, I don't know. But he enjoyed a tremendous reputation. When he founded Kaiser Fraser, he had to float a stock issue of some $20 million, such as the Tucker Corporation. There's parallels existing here. Now, he had to file a prospectus with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Maybe I shouldn't tap on this. Securities and Exchange Commission. And what you do, you tell the public, the stockholders who are going to invest in the company, exactly what you're going to do. They stated, we are going to build a front-wheel drive Kaiser. It will also have torsion bars. The six-cylinder car will cost approximately $1,000. The eight-cylinder car will cost approximately $1,200. So this was fine. Securities and Exchange Commission said, fine, we'll certainly authorize. We'll authorize a new a prospectus and allow you to grant you $20 million. Float the stock issue at $20 million. We would feel a lot better, though, if you would present to the stockholders a smaller, lower production automobile. This turned out to be the Henry J. And there had been a company, there was an American body company that had developed the Henry J body car for somebody. It could have been Huffmobile trying to come back. We want a cheap body that holds 4 or 5 people. And the body had been sitting dormant for 2 or 3 years, and all we had to do was just design a front end for it and some rear fenders, and that would be the Henry J. The body was really outdated, the roof wasn't right, but it was a real cheap way of saving millions and millions of dollars, of at least using the body and just doing some refinements on emphasis on the fenders and the new hood, and that would get him into the game. When the Kaiser Fraser car was introduced, Securities and Exchange said, "What happened to the front-wheel drive philosophy?" They said, "Well, it didn't work. We ran into serious problems with the differential. We mounted the engine above the front differential. The hood got very high, and we ran into problems with our torsion bar suspension." Now, he had deviated from the prospectus, but he had such a colorful background that the Securities and Exchange Commission just merely stated amongst themselves, "By God, we'll never let this happen again." Now, there's somebody in Chicago trying to build an automobile called the Tucker. And if he ever files a prospectus, and if he even looks at us cross-eyed, we'll just nail him to the wall. But they couldn't touch Henry Kaiser. And so at Kaiser Fraser now, I sort of sense the death rattle from a few conversations I had. I looked at the thing and I said, "Well, maybe we might make it 8 months or so." But I saw a little hope on the horizon in some projects. I thought that the Henry J was a disaster. And I figured what this country really needs is a small front-wheel drive automobile with a four-cylinder engine. And fortunately, Dean Hammond, of aircraft fame, who was the father of the first tricycle landing gear, Hammond-Sturman combination. And I had a wonderful feeling towards each other because, number one, I insisted the car had to be aerodynamic, and I'm talking to an aerodynamist who understands what I'm talking about. And then we had a Victor Bogazion from Paris, who was formerly chief engineer of aluminum of France, who was an aluminum expert. And now we talked of building this automobile, and we were going to buy the two largest German stamping plants, where the whole underbody of an automobile, was a 5,000 ton thing, would come down with one big bang, and the whole bottom of the car in aluminum led to weight savings that we just couldn't, that people just simply wouldn't believe. Remember, our technology in those days was that if you designed a Ford for 3,000 pounds, a typical car like a Ford, you'd probably wind up with a 3,300 pound car. And so there was always a tendency in those days, if you designed a windshield pillar and you figured, gee, we'd like to get 2.5 inches but we thickness, but we better play safe and make it 3. And someone else would say, "Oh, let's play safe and make it 3.5. So this is where the snowballing in weight would come up. Today the computers get us down to the way we used to think years ago in aircraft, where it was anathema to miss a target by 3%. Or 5% was disgraceful. So it looked like this new car, really there was a very fabulous, a lot of fabulous thinking. It not only gave us the opportunity to design a military Jeep that only weighed 1,000 pounds, half the weight of the typical Jeep. We do it all in aluminum. In fact, when we tested, and here I go again. Now I'm going. I'm scattering my shots all over the place. I'm trying to tie in certain recollections. But I remember I did a car called the Sun Goddess, and this I talked to Edgar Kaiser. And I said, this will be America's first true hardtop. I see a trend evolving on the horizon. And Edgar Kaiser said, yeah, but Alex, look, what you're talking about to do, this is going to cost at least $4 million to tool, and we just lost $14 million. And I said, Edgar, look at it this way. Supposing we made $20 million, not only pay for the cost, and what's really going to happen is that you can nullify the losses of that $14 million. And because you're going to see a tremendous interest in the hardtops. Convertibles are on the way out, but to preserve that sportiness, you do it with a hardtop, which is safer. There's a lot of advantages to it. You're a fresh air fiend. You can blow air into the rear passengers, and you got windows to stop it when you want it. Well, it sounds good, but we just simply can't afford it. Now, the companies that know how to take a calculated risk are the ones that are going to survive. You've got to have a certain amount of advanced thinking in order to stay alive. You got to be two jumps ahead of everybody. The problem is we're so timid that we look at automotive news as the Bible and look at the 10-day sales curve and say, hey, you know, these Fords, why don't we just look what Pontiac's doing? And can you Pontiac it a little bit? You'd be surprised.
You obviously are a maverick at this point in terms of automotive design, and you're becoming sort of the complete advanced design person in the industry.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So you're moving into Ford in the early 50s.
Okay.
How did your somewhat radical theories impact on Ford design thinking, and how did they come to fruition in terms of finished or prototypical design?
Okay, I got to get to the tail end of Kaiser Fraser. Kaiser Fraser was now dying, and I was asked to give a speech on advanced styling. And this was in 1952. So I was a member of the SAE, so I wrote a paper on the role of the advanced stylist. And of course I had to clear it with Kaiser Fraser. Sid Taylor was our chief engineer at the time. And I cleared it with him, and he said, Alex, this is pretty wild. But he said, by the time you give this talk, we're going to be out of business anyway. So just say any damn thing that you want. And so I got up there, and oh, there were some people on the panel. One was Harry Chesbrough, chief engineer of Chrysler. And now I'm the defense attorney, let's say, for the styling section. And I expected some critique from Harry Chesbrough because he's an engineer, and I knew his views on styling were diametrically opposed to mine, such as how important is styling when you can only see it about 6 or 7 months out of the year because for 5 months it's covered with snow, you know. He didn't understand the geographics and the trends of what people really like to see or hear. So I gave this speech. It was a very controversial speech. Now, when you're giving a talk to the SAE, no matter what you say, right or wrong, is always greeted with mild applause. Now, this was a real smasheroo. Number one, the major thrust that I was trying to indicate, and I was to start talking about airplanes again and all that. I said, we got to stop the torture of innocent air, that our automobiles are aerodynamic monstrosities. We have engines of 300 to 350 horsepower that give us 120 mile an hour maximum speeds. And we're in the midst of a horsepower race. And my philosophy is that we've got to cut the weight and horsepower down drastically. Horsepower we can cut in half. I think it's disgraceful that you're only using at 60 miles an hour 32 to 36 horsepower to cruise. That's rolling resistance and aerodynamic drag. And you have a surplus of over 250 horsepower left to accelerate you to 120 miles an hour. That we should be designing cars to go faster with the leastest, and leastest in this case is horsepower. Well, this wasn't a very popular role at all. Then I went on to say that we have to extrapolate the future, and then I pointed out that at that time where the numbers were like this: since oil was discovered, in the last 10 years we have burned more oil than in the preceding 110 years. And at that time, Detroit was building 85% of all the world's cars. And we should take a good look at what's going on in Europe, and we should take a real good look at what's going on in the Orient, where they're forced to build smaller cars because of the roads, and that we would have to eventually get rid of these big juggernauts. And then, this is 52 now, and I said by the turn of the century, perhaps the year 2000, we may be down to the last 10% of what we've got left. And oh, this aroused a lot of static, where Harry Chesbrough got up and said, Chrysler is not in the business of building automobiles for the entertainment of hiring automobile stylists. Boy, just like that. Funny part of it is that years later, he and I became very close friends. Yeah, but boy, he really was trying to shoot me down at that time. And I stated, Mr. Chesbrough, I said, unless you take a real good look at your styling activity, you may not be around much longer building automobiles, you know. I'm a pro at knowing how to commit political suicide. I got all the answers.
That was prophetic.
Yes, it was, sure. And, oh, God, I showed some real wild automobiles. Good Lord, double Catamarans, solving the problem. The way I approach advanced styling, I walked into a design room one time and I heard the guys discussing and having a battle on the merits of a front engine car versus a rear engine automobile. And I took a look at it and I says, well, I'm going to settle a controversy once and for all. I'm going to put it in the middle. And I put the two streamlined fuselages there with the engine in the middle, air goes in, no interruption, you're exhausted out the back, you're using less horsepower, but you're going to be traveling at high speeds, of cruising at 100 miles. We're going to have century freeways, 100 mile an hour. That's what President Johnson wanted anyway. And we're going to double our mileage. It's all whatever we do aerodynamically. And it was an earth shaker. This is the first time in the history of the SAE that people booed. 50% of them stood up. I thought they were all going to the washroom at the same time. And I got a standing ovation. Then I had people. I remember Don Copra was the first one there working at Chrysler to come over and congratulate me. Then along comes Elwood Engel. He wanted me to join George Walker right away because they had the consulting account for Ford. And Frank Hershey came over from Ford. And so right off the bat, I had a job to go to Ford. So I went to Ford. And I started out as a senior stylist, as I pointed out. And then when Gil Spear wanted to build full-size cars, and he was Mr. Advanced Styling in those days, full-size cars, and forget training students, he had enough of that. Then I inherited Advanced Styling. And that was when I started to run amok with the wildest creed, you know. The battle cry there was, we've got to break the back of General Motors, but we need 5 years, and we need a budget of 15% of our total styling budget. It's car wars, Star Wars, air wars. They're all the same. And I was strictly in air wars, or car wars, yeah, but with the philosophy of. My views are very strong. I joined Ford, and then I started what I had had a brief stint at General Motors many years before, but I knew the GM aristocracy. They're great designers, and they've been there for years. People like Jerry Palmer was one of my students when I trained him at the Creative Arts and Crafts School in Detroit. Like Elwood Engel, they had shut the door on poor Elwood Engel when he was at Chrysler. He wasn't giving enough money to Art Center, and like we were giving at Ford. And this is after I left Ford, but he wanted me to build an advanced styling section as far as the at the school, and do it real quick in a year or so. And I said, only God can make a tree. I mean, they've been there for so many years; they really started the thing. But it's research. You're going to win the war only. Whatever you do has got to be better than what the competition is. I think the most classic example. This goes back, now I'm going back to right field again. When the ME-262 appeared on the horizon, we were developing the P-80. We figured we've got to get into this jet race before the war ends. The ME-262s had a flying jump on us because they had come up with some very fantastic turbo engines, jet engines. We had 4,000 horse, 4,000 pounds of thrust in our TG-180s, which was our mainstay engine, a very sophisticated engine built by Allison. We had buckets were made of titanium. It took, you were lucky to get 2-3 engines a week. Now along comes this mysterious new airplane, the ME-262, that has a capability of 550 miles an hour, in camouflage paint even, faster if they took the paint off. It's got two engines that develop 3,200 horsepower, 3,200 pounds of thrust. The diameter was 32 inches versus our TG-180's 40 inches. Smaller engines, but less power. But they had two engines versus our P-80's single engine. The secret of that engine was a masterpiece of engineering. The buckets, which were the blades, were stainless steel stampings like this. Could stand tremendous heat, and they were open on top, which meant that they could cool these blades by circulation through the open part. And this would lead into a thrust augmentation as it went out the tailpipe. So we called in a meeting for Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler to come in and look at these Jumo 004s. And they spent about a week with us discussing technology, the numbers, the stamping necessary, the life of the engines. And we wound up with figures like Ford says we can build 500 a month. General Motors says, well, if Ford can build 500, if they double everything, we can build 1,000 a month, you know. But we figured that Ford was the prime. We were more interested in what Ford could do, because they had a scientific laboratory, for one thing, and they were working on the philosophy of scientific laboratory was, we want you guys to start thinking in terms of projects so advanced that you won't even live long enough to see them realized. And that was a healthy philosophy. They really did an awful lot of exploration. Now they came to me and they said, okay, Tremulous, you're going to be the Luftwaffe. We're putting you on a special project. You got to go 90 days. You got to do it in 90 days. We expect you to design 3 aeroplanes. And you're going to use it, you're going to design it around Jumo 004 engines against the Air Force. Downstairs, they'll be battling with you. So I said, if I'm the Luftwaffe, I got to do it the way I want to do it. I want a swastika hanging from my balcony. And it didn't take long for somebody to give me a German officer's cap and a piece of black tape like this, and I was Adolf Hitler with a German dictionary, which they couldn't see, and I'd heil, boom, 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 and just read off these German names. Next day I was bombarded with apples, tomatoes, and all, so that ceased. But the thing was, I had to be the Luftwaffe. And I practiced it that way, because you get an insight from military intelligence, what they're doing, and what we think it takes to win a war. And it turned out that we won the competition upstairs with 3 of the aeroplanes. One didn't quite make it right, because I had the engines on the wingtips, and if an engine never went, they lost an engine. It would do that, and everything would scatter, but it looked good. As I say, you got to be inquisitive by nature. You have to challenge the axiom. When they say you can't go faster than the speed of sound, if you do that, you stop your technology. You stop your thinking. Your creativity comes to a dead standstill. But if someone says, boy, the sky's the limit, go, 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 that's when, after I got out of the Air Force, I was called back as a consultant. I worked for General Sverdrup Sverdrup and Parcell. They built all the wind tunnels. And when I look at the wind tunnels that they're building today, if I told you the size wind tunnels that we were talking about as to what it would take to beat the Russians in the next 5 years, I was told to just look at the numbers and go into outer space. The theory was, you're an Imagineer. You really don't know what you're really doing. But we got enough people here that can take some of these concepts and reduce them to practice. And you're an accidental breakthrough. You all guessed us all these times. So now I had to completely design a whole new Air Force. And then we talked in terms of a million pound thrust rocket. It had a nozzle that was 18 feet. And I remembered at that time that there's a Buick was 18 foot long. So I draw this nice scale drawing, and underneath there I park a Buick underneath the nozzle to give them a scale effect. And from there, test stands for Edwards Air Force Base. They tell me to go to Edwards and see some of the test stands that I designed, which I hadn't seen yet. And that led to my meeting with the astronauts, and I got along fine with them. Just great.
Yeah, you've now brought your aerodynamic design thinking to Ford in the early 50s.
Yes.
And can you, in the remaining minutes, give us a feeling for how what the reception was by the Standing Chiefs at this time?
The Standing Chiefs didn't understand aerodynamics. Whenever I was on the verge of selling a wind tunnel program or an aerodynamic program, I was always shot down. They would say, but Alex, remember the Chrysler Airflop. And I'd say, we've been beating that poor dead horse for over 30 years. There's nothing wrong with the car. And some of the greatest criticism came from people like Bill Schmidt, one of our best designers there, of Lincoln Mercury for years. And you say, Alex, you know that aerodynamics doesn't work till after 80 miles an hour. And I said, baloney, comes in at 30. And then I used to look at the models that were there, and I'd tell Bill, I'd say, Bill, let me tell you something. Of all these beautiful models here, and they're all supposed to look aerodynamic, do you realize that you've got the best aerodynamic automobile in this XL500? And you admit that nothing to aero, you just have a beautiful subconscious feel of an aerodynamic form. And he was the one who said, it just won't work, it's ridiculous, 80 miles an hour. You look at a guy pedaling a bicycle. He cranks, let's say, 7 cranks. One is dedicated to moving the bicycle. One crank out of the 7 or the 8. And the next 7 are dedicated to the sole task of conquering the air resistance. That's why bicyclists, world champions, can go 40 miles an hour. Now we've got streamliners that are doing over 60 miles an hour, and that's just the start. You're going to see bicycles, I mean human-powered things. It's very simple. I mean, you design for 4/10 of a horsepower and streamline the shell. And this applies to automobiles. It applies to everything. It applies to home run balls. If you're curious enough, a young aerodynamics student asked me, what kind of a rocket should I design for my thesis at Ann Arbor? And should I design a bomber? Should I do this? But he was a baseball fanatic. And one day he said, guess what happened? There were more home runs hit in the American and the National League on such and such a day in 1955. A rash of home runs that nobody had ever seen. So I says, well, okay, you want to talk aerodynamics and not put people to sleep? Why not do the aerodynamics of the well-hit home run ball? What had happened is that throughout the country, when all these baseball teams were hitting home runs, the temperature was in the high 90s. Air drag was low. At normal temperature,